Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to a new episode of the Talking About Platforms podcast. My name is Philip Meyer, and I'm here with my regular co-host, Daniel Trabucchi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Philip. Hi, everyone.
And we have an exciting guest today, whose name is Jeffrey Parker. He's a professor of engineering at the School at Dartmouth College,
where he also serves as the faculty director at the Irving Institute for Energy and Society.
Jeff was awarded the Thinkers 50 Digital Thinking Award for work on the two-sided markets and the inverted firm. And his book, Platform Revolution, co-authored with Marcia van Alstyne and Sangeet Chaudhary, sold more than 200 copies, probably more, now it's even more than that, worldwide. And so some might say that beyond just analyzing the topic, that he himself and his co-authors accelerated a cross-industry platform revolution. With that, welcome to Talking About Platforms, Jeff.
Philip, Daniel, thank you so much for having me here. It's great to be on.
You know, the title of the podcast is Talking About Platforms, and we aim to have here people that in their life talk about platforms and to have a chat with them about it. Still, we are aware that we are not always aligned on what platform means. So we usually start with a question that is, what is a platform to you and how you end up studying platforms? I guess that having you being you one of the authors of Platform Revolution, the first question can even be skipped, but we would like to know something about how you end up studying platforms. What's your story in this research field?
I'm going to date myself. This goes back a long time. So Marshall van Alstyne and I were doctoral students together at MIT. And at the very beginning of our discussions, it was really around content and specifically Twin Peaks getting canceled. And you say, how in the world did eclectic television and its cancellation get you onto a platform journey? And I'll explain. So if you dig into the business model, of course, that's an ad-sponsored network. And that got us thinking, okay, well, how do those work? How do you think about an advertiser side of a network and then the consumers? And in particular, at that time, you couldn't do the narrowcasting that you get now with systems like Netflix and Hulu and HBO and all the rest. And so this very narrow or niche content couldn't survive. So that was the beginning of our conversations. But what really kicked it off was our noticing, frankly, that if you look out on the web, and you have to remember, this is right before the dot-com crash. So we're in the middle of the dot-com boom. And you could get an IPO if you simply put the word dot-com, you know, boo.com or any kind of crazy idea without a business model would all of a sudden attract all kinds of capital. That got us interested because we started seeing a lot of things that you would have expected to pay money for 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So, for example, when spreadsheets first became popular and you had the rise, second mover of Excel, I remember buying that, or our first copies of Lotus 1-2-3, they cost $500 for a box of diskettes. Now, I tell my students this story, and I say, so how much money did you pay for Google Sheets? And they look at me like I'm crazy. Like, well, nothing. I said, well, actually, you do pay for it, and we'll explain the business model. how much did you pay for a browser? Well, nothing. Web browsers are free, of course. And I said, well, actually, they're really not. Those are pretty robust pieces of software. They take an enormous amount of resource commitment to bring forward and then to maintain. And that was true early on with things like, Netscape and then Internet Explorer, and of course the Mosaic and earlier versions prior to that. That matters because what we started to see was a pattern of free goods, free services that once upon a time cost money. And so you say, well, that can't last, forever. There has to be some sort of way that this system operates. Like, why is it in someone's interest to create this high quality software or a high quality service? And then how is it that it doesn't seem to get charged for going forward? And so, of course, that got us to being really formal about two-sided networks, two-sided network effects, and then why does one side enjoy a subsidy, and how is it that it makes sense to charge a different side to get access to the first side? And so we worked that all out, in terms of the theory. That was a lot of industrial organization economics, really building on people like Katz and Shapiro. We lived with our gentural kind of microeconomics, industrial organization, texts for some foundational models, and then built that out. So that was great. And at that point, the dot-com crash had occurred. And so now you're moving into kind of the ashes. And so all the silly business models had been wiped out. All the, I'm just going to call it a fancy name and they'll attract all kinds of capital. That was gone. But the noticing of content and services that were provided at no cost to at least one side of the network, those persisted. And so what we saw rise from the ashes, if you will, of the dot-com bust were the beginnings of the tech giants that you know today. So now you're seeing the Amazons come forward. You're seeing the Facebooks come forward. Now Meta. You're seeing the rise of Google. And then ultimately, Microsoft did pivot back and become sort of an internet-oriented company away from kind of a standalone product company. So that was fascinating to us because that moved us from thinking about the narrow question of why is this market or this market participant subsidized, and how is it that it makes economic sense for that subsidy to be in perpetuity, to the broader question of what's driving the growth of these technology firms. And so that brought us into really being clear and hopefully thoughtful and articulating what is a platform, what are the basic kind of economic drivers of harnessing network effects, of harnessing bundling, of leveraging sort of fixed cost infrastructures so you can then layer on products and services at low marginal cost, and then take advantage of both scale economies as well as these network effect or demand side economies of scale. So that's sort of the beginning. And I realize I probably jumped forward a fair bit, but it really was a simple question. Why all this free stuff?
That's super, super exciting. Thinking about this, like being so active in the dot-com boom and then the dot-com bust, looking into this like new emerging way of organizing, like business model, organizing technologies all coming together. Was there a moment or a series of moments that you felt, oh, this topic really has legs, that this is really not going anywhere?
I'm glad you asked that because honestly, we were pretty sure it was super important 25 years ago. Like we said to ourselves, this is really important. Now, did anybody else believe us? No, we had to fight a lot of uphill battles just to get our original work published. And that's a whole separate story and one better told to doctoral students at the beginning of their career about the craziness of two assistant professors deciding to engage in those contests. But We knew that that was important, but I don't think we had any idea how important it was, because that was a theory that was important around pricing in markets. But I'd say by the late 2000s, 2005, 2006, it was becoming really clear to us that we could lay out tons of examples of how this was going to become important as a new way to organize. And then we wrote our HBR article, Two-Sided Markets, in 2006, really before all of the market caps exploded, and kind of laid out the basic structure and how the systems worked.
I'm quite curious in knowing how it goes on in the next years after, till platform revolution.
So at that point, that was our effort to explain theory to a broader audience and to translate it. So without all the math and without the formality, but to lay it out in kind of a set of clear examples and principles. And then we started working more in the strategy space, and thinking, well, okay, what are some of the strategic implications of this? And to do that, we teamed up again with Tom Eisenman, who's a co-author on the HBR paper, professor of entrepreneurship at Harvard, and we wrote the paper Platform Envelopment. Now, that came out in 2011 in Strategic Management Journal. We submitted the first version of that in 2008. So we actually began that work immediately after writing the HBR article, because that was then saying, hey, this is a bigger idea. And we were all three of us fully bought into that. And we got an interesting kind of response as we went to the journal, and it said, well, what conversation are you joining? And we said, well, actually, there's a conversation that needs to be started. You know, this field, and now this is completely, you know, caught up, and, you know, things are exploding in the platform and ecosystem space in the strategy kind of scholarship, and also, of course, in practice. But at the time, it really wasn't. And so, again, it was another uphill battle that took several years to kind of get people to agree, okay, yeah, this is important and we need to talk about it. So here was what we were thinking. So at the time, Marshall and I were teaching maybe 50 students a year, which is great. The students were interested. We had a lot of pretty kind of robust theory and frameworks, and then lots of interesting examples. I mean, you could just sort of open the news on any given day and pull examples as things were starting to pop. But it was still relatively early, in the sense that I'd say the broader world, if you will, of kind of traditional industry, wasn't that bought in or frankly all that interested. Silicon Valley certainly was, so we spent a lot of time out there, but not so much in the banking, automotive, manufacturing, or other sectors. And at the time, one of our co-authors of Platform Revolution, Sangeet Chatterjee, came to our attention, because he was writing a lot of really intriguing blog posts. And so we reached out and said, I think we're all circling around the same thing, and we want to write a book, and you're clearly creating content that we think would be relevant for that. How about we do that as a joint project? Because we wanted to have larger reach. And so we all got together for the summer of 2013 in Boston, and we took over a conference room with glass walls, and used kind of whiteboard pens, and filled those glass walls with the content of every chapter, you know, sort of merging Sangeet's content in with Marshall's and my material that we had developed over more than a decade to teach our kind of information economics and strategy classes. And that was the foundation of the book, but it was really the desire to reach a broader audience and our conviction that it was really an important topic that people needed a better understanding of. And we wrote it from the point of view of both a student, but also a practitioner, you know, somebody who might want to take the ideas and implement them, at a minimum, understand them and understand the impact. But our ambition was greater than that. It was really to help people implement the ideas. And so it's been super gratifying when you meet with people, and they said, oh yeah, I was given that by one of my leaders, or I asked my entire senior leadership team to read it, and then we took elements of that, adapted it, and then were able to deploy that as part of our strategy. I mean, that's incredibly gratifying, and I don't know, you know, how often that happens to academics. So I think you just sort of have to be thankful when it does. And then the book came out in 2013. We wrote the core, we kind of architected it in the summer of 2013, but it came out in about January of 2016, and the timing was almost perfect. And the reason is that was right at the time that the tech giants surpassed the banks, the oil companies, the giants of retail, the giants of manufacturing, to pretty much become the largest market cap companies. We were convinced it was super important way before that happened, but then that gave validation to the broader world that said, okay, maybe we need to pay attention to this. In fact, we certainly need to pay attention to this because it's now driving the economy as we see it right in our face.
Well, that's so, so fascinating. And I can tell you that still, talking to students also in executive education or on industry fairs, Platform Revolution is a book that's still referenced by practitioners today. That they not just say, this is where I started my journey, but that they say, this is still relevant to me and to my work today. And I also reflected on that. And I mean, 2016, now you said you basically built the framework of the book in 2013. It's quite a while up until today. And when I thought about it, I looked up some events that happened between 2016 and today. And I would like to hear your opinion on the impact of some of these events on how your thinking about platforms has developed over time. So for example, we have in the field of regulation, we have the General Data Protection regulation implementation in 2018. We have the California Consumer Privacy Act in 2020. Then when it comes to accountability, we have the Facebook Cambridge Analytica data scandal in 2018 that probably had a massive impact. And when it comes to new technologies, we of course have the race of the rise of artificial intelligence since I would say maybe 18-19. And before that, this short but still continuing period of blockchain and distributed system technologies. So thinking about the regulation and maybe the, let's say, increasing sensitivity of a broader society with these high market caps and the increasing power of the platforms and the technical development. If we think about these three different categories, what are your thoughts when you like think about the publishing of the book 2016 up until right now, how your thinking about platforms has changed over time?
Yeah,
or maybe not.
Well, right. And a little bit of both. So it's incredibly gratifying to hear that people still find it relevant. The good news is we should have a follow-on book out, which is largely written. We're late, and thankfully so, because had we gotten out before the rise of generative AI, we would have been obsolete almost immediately. So why still relevant? I'd like to think that because we spent a lot of time grounding the book in sort of fundamental physics, I mean, and by that I mean sort of the fundamental economics, that the examples will change, the names will come and go, but the forces of network effects, the forces of supply side scale, the forces of demand side scale, the kind of ways that organizations can bundle, the ways that organizations kind of create governance structures to manage ecosystems, those are all not going to change year to year. The ways that we see them exist in the marketplace will change. But so the fundamental ideas, I think, tend to be pretty robust. And if you go back, even into the 90s, Hal Varian, and I think in Carl Shapiro's book, Information Rules, they have some archaic examples. They talk about diskettes. I have to explain what that means to students now. But a lot of the economics that they described is every bit as valid today. And that was one of the things that we looked and drew inspiration from, which was to say, you know, we want to work in sort of fundamental economics. What are the transaction costs? How are you taking them down? You know, how do platforms aggregate very small network effects in order to create value? So those all would have an economic underpinning. Okay, so now you asked questions around kind of three areas. I think regulation is one that's completely different in the landscape from, say, 10, 11 years ago. And so we're having to just fundamentally address it. And to your point, because of the increasing power, the concern, the pushback of, say, governments against the encroachment potentially of some of the platforms, and especially you have some Chinese examples in that regard, you've got Europe leading the way, if you will, in thinking about the use of data, the ownership of data, its portability, and we were fortunate to get on the inside of a little bit of that by being asked to be on a panel of economists to help comment on the Digital Markets Act. And then we've tried to engage, you know, not at a heavy level, but engage the European regulators ongoing. So if I step back, I'd say we were rosier in 2013 or 2016 about platforms than we would be today. I think we'd be clearer-eyed and say there are things that platforms will do to self-govern when it's in their interest, when it's happening within their system, and when self-governance is aligned, you know, with their own goals. But there are a lot of other things where they create negative externalities for society. And those are things that, you know, the platforms will not naturally self-regulate. And that is an area where you really need to have external forces step in. So I think that's one that is just clearly there. So you asked another question, and I think that regulation, you asked about the increasing power of platforms. I think they go hand in hand. You know, what's been fascinating, I hate to say the word longevity, but just how powerful some of our biggest technology players have become and haven't really been challenged. And you'd say, hey, what about OpenAI? What about NVIDIA? What about sort of the companies that are also growing? NVIDIA is interesting because in some ways they remind you of Qualcomm a generation ago, where they're really supplying critical components, but the demand is still being driven by the scalers, by the OpenAIs, and then by the big tech companies themselves. But, you know, and here I mean primarily Google Cloud, Amazon Web, and Microsoft Azure as being sort of the big, and Meta too, being the big companies that are investing now very heavily in AI. And so isn't that interesting that the companies that were the powerful technology platforms are now just seamlessly morphing into the powerful AI players? And you'd say, well, why? And you'd look and say, well, who has the data? You know, I mean, a cloud service provider that's organizing and powering the operations of millions of enterprises and billions of people, of course, that's where the data is getting centralized. And so it makes perfect sense that that's where you would then start to see a lot of AI applications and AI as a service start to come on. Yeah, and I'll kind of comment on the blockchain, because I think that's a really interesting one. And there was sort of a a wave of interest in that, with the idea, well, that'll displace the coordinating capability of a platform, you know, by this sort of distributed autonomous organization, and do away with it. The challenge there is a lot of systems still ended up benefiting from a central coordinator, benefiting from kind of the dynamic adaptation of governance that's needed when things are not, or that can benefit, you know, the various stakeholders and users when things aren't really stable. So, you know, instead of a substitute, I expected, and it hasn't really come to pass, but I still expect to see those types of technologies be complements to the existing technology companies and business models, as opposed to substitutes. You know, where they can substitute in some narrower cases where there's more stability.
One company that you did not mention as a big NVIDIA customer is Tesla, right? Who also like just bought a big data center. I think they now share it in some interesting capacity with X and XAI. But I also know that you have a very, very interesting study on the charging infrastructure that Tesla built. And I wonder, did Elon like understand platforms and in infrastructures, the role of infrastructures so well, or was it somehow a game of luck that he, on the one hand, with Tesla, built this charger network, with SpaceX, built the, let's say, space internet infrastructure that so many now rely on. Now he's also transforming a Twitter. So that guy is playing the platform game pretty well, it seems to me.
Good call out. I remember giving a talk at MIT in 2013. That was our first platform strategy symposium. And I was talking about, I think it was titled The Platform Revolution. And then toward the end, I called out the accidental platforms. And actually, I denoted Apple as one, because they were, and in many ways continue to be, sort of a hardware first company, at least in terms of how they monetize. But by building iTunes out and then investing, of course, in the smartphone and then opening up the App Store, those were technologies that then created a platform kind of around their hardware strategy, which was really interesting. But it was hard to see that as super intentional at the time. I think they were pretty fortunate. So why to mention this? I think the charging network is a really good example where Tesla vertically integrated into the missing complement. And the missing complement, of course, was the ability to travel long distances, you know, reliably, and that meant the whole supercharger network. And it's really interesting how they were able to use the deposits, because their manufacturing capacity took a long time to scale to be able to satisfy demand. But those deposits gave them early signals of where the locus of demand would be, that they could then invest in the supercharger stations ahead of time to then have that network in place. So I think they were playing a complements game where they had to vertically integrate. It ended up being a really good kind of platform game that they were playing. It's also remarkable that they got to have a 10 or 15 year head start in terms of the sluggish response, I would say, of the incumbent industry.
Why do you think they were so resistant to building a reasonable competitor to Tesla?
It's new technology. It actually poses a threat to a lot of the value chain. So if you think about the dealer network, a lot of the profits are realized after the sale. The sale tends to be at relatively low margin, and then you monetize on the service operations. And so this particular product has the potential of having much lower service costs. And so that threatens sort of the revenue stream of parts of the value of the value chain. So that's maybe part one. Part two is, especially in the US, you know, the whole sort of big truck SUV part of the market was where all the profits were. And that was going to take a long time to be able to create EVs that were made sense. And they're coming on now, but that wasn't an obvious first use case. So you really had to have a lot of vision toward the future that those technologies would pan out. So that's kind of part two. And then part three, and I think this is really important, is the big auto companies were kind of blessed, or at least 100 years ago, it has been 100 years since they've had to face the complement problem. I mean, at the very beginning, there was no global refueling infrastructure network. Now, of course, there is. And so you, as a product designer, developer at one of the incumbent kind of internal combustion oriented companies, you can take that for granted. You don't need to think about it. But you had to think about that if you wanted to enter this, and they weren't willing to go it alone to do the investment, and they weren't doing coalitions. So it's actually just a fascinating story to see how they took a long time to respond.
Yeah, totally. I know that you are currently also particularly looking into energy and B2B contexts. We talked about this before. I also did my PhD on B2B platforms. And I wonder, when I looked into or the platforms that I used as case studies, some of them are not existing anymore. Others are more flourishing and others are doing so good, let's say. I think in B2B you have, and you write this also publish this in a great piece, categorizing or helping to understand the perspective on B2B and how it's different in different dimensions. Thinking about the B2B context, I see some challenges that companies that want to tap into this context and build a platform have to consider. One is for sure potentially insufficient network effects. One is for sure complex sales cycles that they might need to engage in, maybe a challenging and complex core transaction that they have to deal with, integration challenges with legacy systems. And I'm sure you can name more. When you look at such a context, do you have a hierarchy of things or some kind of framework how you like assess when you, for example, talk with management in a B2B setting, to say, okay, all right, let's take a step back and first look is there like a spot for a platform here or not?
Yeah, great question. And honestly, Philip, you nailed many of the things that I would have talked about. So I'll try to answer or try to add something that you, I'm sure you know, but didn't say out loud, which is, I think it's often best to not start as a platform. Offering a really robust product or service and getting a set of users who see value in that, not the worst way to go. So in terms of thinking about the value proposition, I think it's really layered out over a series of years. So you start with, and you know, this will be kind of your core enterprise software concept. You start out with some sort of core system that delivers value to an end user. Great. Well done. Now you have some choices to make about how to increase that value proposition. And so they can be harnessing the data from the users, packaging those up as new services or AI insights, using machine learning, whatever your core technologies are. And so that's using sort of the activity of the users, aggregating the information and then repackaging those. So that at some level becomes either a scale effect or a data network effect. I mean, we can sort of quibble about the terms, but the point is the more people that use it, the more value that you're able to create for those users. So that's kind of one path of adding more value over time. And then that implies a whole kind of platform product team and a roadmap and a vision of how you would bring that to life. And then another path is kind of this cross-side network effect. And that's your ecosystem play. That's building out a marketplace or attracting sort of third-party organizations that can then start to add value for your users without you having to manage all of the engineering. Now, to your point, it's a much more complex environment because, as you said, you've got kind of complex sales cycles, a complex core transaction, and then all of these integration challenges. And if you kind of zoom out and say, well, what's the nature of the problem that you're solving in B2B versus B2C? I'd say in B2C, which is where we learned most of what we know, a lot of the issues are kind of market failures. And they're market failures for lots of different reasons. Information asymmetry would be a good one, where the platform can help level that playing field, or transaction costs that are so high that interactions that could create value for the parties are impossible for various reasons. And so the platforms can kind of enter those markets, bring down the transaction costs, and then solve a market failure. I think on the B2B side, and my co-author Sangeet has been quite eloquent on this, it's really about coordination failures. You've got this kind of multi-party complexity where if you layer in a whole bunch of point solutions without having some sort of a common bus, you end up with these end-to-end integrations where you'd rather have one-to-end. And so a B2B platform can help solve some of that coordination cost and bring that down. And then in terms of, you mentioned insufficient network effects, I think that's right. You know, the end users may not care that there are only 100 end kind of applications instead of a million. You know, they may not value the range or the diversity so much as the depth of capability. But on the data side, I think that's where you can capture a lot of information and then make use of it. So I just think the nature of kind of how you're creating value for end users is it's sort of the same economics, or the economics are there, but they're kind of showing up in different buckets.
You know, there was a sentence that really got my attention in what you said. At a certain point, you said one path might be building up a great product and then joining the platform revolution. And somehow that answer was bridging the research that Philip is doing on B2B platform with what Tommaso and I are doing with platform thinking and established firms joining the platform revolution. And I have a curiosity on what you see on your experience in the platform world, the challenges that established firms can see in switching to a platform model are quite easy to be mentioned. What are, in your opinion, the enablers that make that transition smoother?
Yeah. So this is one I have a lot of conviction around. I've been fortunate to get to work with quite a few organizations, and they'll often say, hey, love what you've been writing about platforms. We want to be a platform. And then you get in and you have a look and you're like, I love the vision. I sort of see the long run of sort of where you're trying to go in this industry and the broad set of problems that you're trying to solve, but you're not there yet. Okay, well, why? Because a lot of times those organizations are busy deploying point solutions. So the way their engineering functions are designed is to look for best of breed things like the best chatbot or the best voice to text sort of AI system, or, you know, whatever the solution might be, and then integrate that in. But if you look at their tech stack, it's old and it's in silos as opposed to horizontal. So I end up saying, well, so the good news is you've got this ambition. The bad news is You've got a big digital transformation to undergo, with all of the kind of challenges that that implies, because as you're no doubt well aware, a lot of those digital transformation efforts fail. I think they fail because the firms often they think that they know more than they do, and they invest more sooner than they should without running sort of the appropriate experiments, without building small, solving problems, building the next set of capabilities, using that to solve problems. So I think it's a lot about that digital transformation and infrastructure build that precedes the platform. And then a lot of this comes down to kind of how you build products, how you identify the problems that you're going to solve. And you might recognize that language from kind of product operating model world of people like Kagan and many other authors. But I think it matters here, because you'll end up needing a whole platform product management function that can serve the needs of both the internal users of this system, but critically also the external users. So I think there's just a big journey, especially an incumbent company, because a startup will kind of naturally solve these problems. They have to. An incumbent company, you know, is blessed with resources, customers, transactions, data, and they're burdened with existing systems, existing sort of verticals and power structures, all of which would be threatened by this transition to a different way of both creating value by using external partners, but also capturing value by having different types of business models that may compete directly by opening up new channels with their existing kind of business units. So I think, you know, that those are the kinds of challenges that you have to help organizations navigate.
And that it resonates so well with me with what you're saying. I was in 2016, 17, 18, I was quite involved with a big German car manufacturer. The company also, on the one hand, was developing strategies for building mobility platforms, thinking about competing with Uber, building shared ride networks. And on the other hand, like the basic work and basic challenges were, for example, that the hardware developments of the new vehicle model were not disconnected from the software development. So it was one development cycle. So when the hardware was finished, the software had to be finished, right, for the product. So there was no like disconnected ongoing software development for the hardware products in 2017. But when the vehicle is at the end of the development cycle, the software for the vehicle had to be at the end for the development cycle. And then it, like 1 or 2 years later, would hit the market. And this is the history of how the German automotive industry like became so like rich in legacy software, so to say, for the products. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons. And this is also these multifaceted challenges these old companies or traditionally very successful companies have, when on the one hand you have like the digital natives and the McKinseys that come in and say you need to build this mobility platform, and then on the other hand no one really wants to touch these as you called it massive digital transformation endeavors. One thing I would like to mention is the paper that I was referring to. The title is Leveraging Value Creation to Drive the Growth of B2B Platforms. You wrote it with Ed Anderson and Jose Lopez.
Yep.
So we will link it in the show notes. And with that, we are already at the end of our episode, Jeff. Ah. And we always, as we open with the same question, we also close with the same question. And this question to you is, what is next? What are you working on right now? So what do you see on the horizon, be it platform related or not?
So what is next is, I'd say the platform revolution continues. And maybe it's no longer a revolution, but the phenomena is not going away. In terms of, as a scholar, I think it's now about picking niches. So you mentioned earlier the energy systems. So I've spent a fair bit of time in a few industries. So one is healthcare, one is manufacturing logistics, and one is energy systems. And I'm thinking, and the work on B2B is super important, because for this platform kind of transition to take place, a lot of it is going to have a B2B flavor. And so understanding the integration challenges, understanding the complexity of a core transaction, understanding or thinking through how do you reduce transaction costs, how do you think about scalability, is kind of this mix of old supply side scaling with sort of thinking about network effect and data driven economies of scale. So that's where my scholarship is going. And honestly, I'd say the scholarship is following practice in some ways, or trying to at least go in parallel with where I get questions and demand. I mean, you know, I couldn't tell you the number of times where I'd give talks or have meetings with corporates and they'd say, love it. We're a B2B or we're an industrial player. Tell me again how that applies to us. And it was a fair question. So I've spent the last several years really trying to get some better answers to that. And also working with organizations, trying to implement some of these ideas in their settings so that it's not just idle, but you actually kind of get your hands, I hate to say dirty, but put your hands directly on some of the problems. So I've been fortunate, you know, to build an advisory and work and get to work with a number of companies directly answering some of these questions.
Thank you so much for your time, Jeff. We touched so many topics. We started with the pre-dot-com boom, platform economics, multi-sided markets, pricing, then to the early work, HBR, platform development, your later pieces in industrial economics, and then moving to strategy more and more, publishing the platform revolution. Now, soon publishing a second version, an updated version of it, and going or staying true to the topic, but going into so important niches. I think your contributions over the last more than 20 years are so massive. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for your time today, and just the best for everything that's ahead.
Thank you both. This has been really, really fun. You've given me a chance to reflect and project forward. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.